Thank you. So first of all, I would like to thank Daniel for inviting me to this beautiful place, and also for the nice weather. And it's the first time I've seen snow this year, which for Austin is not that usual. So I will be talking about control dynamics in hydrocore atomic systems, and also, of course, want to mention that this research is funded by national funding agencies and by the EU. And I've divided my talk into three different parts, which is somehow artificial, but I will use different methods in each of these parts, and so that's why I've done that. The first part, I will talk about how to load atoms into an optical lattice, and how to make sure that one can use these optical lattices to initialize a quantum register. So what I want to achieve is to have qubits sitting in the egg where defined places, and to be able to use them afterwards using manipulations. In the second part, I want them to present an idea on how to create graph states with these systems, so how one can create multi-parted entangled states without doing much, so without needing a lot of control, without having to build all these gates separately. And in the last part, I will then talk about how to detect such entangled states, so what can be done in an experiment to detect the state and what does one need to be careful with. Now, overall, these three parts should therefore present a coherent way of creating of a quantum register, manipulating it to create multi-parted entangled states, and also to measure and to detect them. So if all of these three things can be implemented, one would have a nice example of a multi-parted quantum computing setup. Now, the research that I'm doing is mostly concerned with optical lattices, and this optical lattice research is closely related to some other fields of physics, in particular to atomic physics. The atomic physics provides us with the basic tools. So in atomic physics, we get a toolbox of building blocks that we can use to set up these optical lattice systems. It provides very clean physical systems so that there is control on the quantum level. So in atomic physics, we can manipulate the atoms at the quantum level and really keep track of the states that that are there in the experiment, and the atoms and also the laser beams that are used have very different properties, so we know exactly which Hamiltonians we're dealing with, and we don't need to guess or write down models that just qualitatively describe the main features of the system. Optical lattices then take these properties and include one thing which was not possible until recently, and this is to control the interactions between the atoms. So in an optical lattice, it is possible to turn interactions between atoms on and off, and via this to create entangled states between the atoms in a controlled way. This can lead to strong correlations, and these strong correlations, or these strongly correlated systems that result in that case, give you the possibility to do coherent dynamics with them. So up to now, if you look at condensed matter systems, these systems never allow for coherent dynamics because there's too much decoherence going on in there. Here in optical lattice systems, we have very slow decoherence mechanisms, and therefore we can get controlled coherent dynamics. But even more, the decoherence that happens in there is controllable to an extent. So we can turn on decoherence and can turn it off in a controlled way, and therefore start studying decoherence mechanisms in a much more controlled way than is usually possible. We have very versatile setups, and these versatile setups, as I will show, allow to create highly entangled states, and for at least practical purposes, these systems are scalable. So the number of atoms usually trapped in optical lattices ranges up to a million, and so we would have a million qubits at our disposal, and that doesn't, at least at the moment, pose any practical restrictions in terms of the size of the quantum computer. Now, in order to describe these systems, there are a lot of things known in condensed matter physics. In particular, condensed matter physics provides us with a host of systems of interest. So what kind of strongly correlated systems do you want to study? And in terms of optical lattices, which kind of systems do you want to simulate? They know which systems give rise to high temperature superconductivity, what other kind of frustrated systems are of interest. And so we can take ideas from these condensed matter systems and try to incorporate them into optical lattices and study them in optical lattices in a much, much cleaner framework. They have also a lot of methods for describing equilibrium properties. So if you look at an optical lattice in thermal equilibrium, we get, or we can use methods that are well known in condensed matter physics and apply them to the optical lattice systems. And the properties that are studied there are only equilibrium and thermal. So now I already said that in optical lattices we do have some coherent dynamics. We have the possibility to have coherent dynamics with strongly correlated systems. And that's where quantum computing and quantum information comes in, because that's where we get the description of entanglement methods for studying unitary dynamics. And we can use the methods that are studied there and used there to describe what's going on in an optical lattice if it evolves coherently. Also, descriptions of noise, so controlling noise, come from the regime of quantum computing. And probably the most important stuff is that quantum computing provides a host of applications for optical lattices, so we can try to realize some of the algorithms and some of the most desirable architectures in optical lattices. Now, the obvious question then, will this ever be directly applicable to condensed matter physics? I will not touch upon that, but maybe in the future sometime there will be condensed matter systems which behave more or less coherently. In the first part, I want to briefly talk about what is an optical lattice and how can we put atoms into this optical lattice such that they realize a qubit. Now, optical lattices are created by pairs of laser beams which shine on a cloud of atoms from orthogonal directions and cause an AC Stark shift in there, which is periodic in space. So what we get is something like an Xbox type of potential. And if one is clever enough, then one can make the atoms sit in the potential minima of these Xbox. If one then asks whether one can use this as a quantum register or not, then the question would be, can I make these atoms sit one atom per lattice site? And the answer to this, whether one can do this or not, and what methods are available for achieving this, is what I will discuss first. Now, such an optical lattice is described by Bose-Hubbard model, or by Fermi-Hubbard model, depending on the type of atoms that one uses, which has two components. The first one is a hopping term, which describes how atoms hop between these different lattice sites. And the second one is an interaction type of Hamiltonian. So we have two atoms sitting in one lattice site getting some repulsive interaction and some shift in energy because of that. And the competition between this energy here, so this interaction energy, and this kinetic energy here can be used to realize a quantum register. And once one has this, and I will talk a bit about more recent methods for doing this, one can then produce a qubit out of such an atom by using two internal states and connecting them via some laser pulses. So what we have then, what we're trying to achieve, is a lattice filled with one atom per each lattice site and using two internal states to realize a qubit. Now, there have been a number of suggestions for how one can do this. So how can one realize one bit or one atom per lattice site? The first one was what we've done in 1998, was basically to just exploit the competition between kinetic energy and interaction energy and drive the system from a superfluid or from a Bose system into a Mott insulating state where one atom occupies each lattice site. Now, this has been done in 2002 in an experiment by Emmanuel Bloch and Ted Hensch, and it works fairly well. So you get quantum registers with about 10% error, but you can't get very much better than that. So if this kind of quantum phase transition is exploited, quantum memory can be realized, but not in a very clean way. A similar thing, just for completeness, was introduced just some time ago for fermions by Marcel Kalak and Smelty in 2004. And I've just listed a few others here which have the promise for getting some improvement on this 10% infidelity that one gets. One was trying to exploit the interaction between the atoms, so selectively emptying sites with two atoms in there and making sites with one atom in there, leaving them untouched, so that one atom out of each of these doubly occupied sites would go away, and so one can get a uniform filling again. Some others propose to measure the empty sides, and then just shift the optical lattice around until each lattice side was filled with exactly one atom. Now, all of these proposals have one big drawback. They are not irreversible. So if you do this kind of scheme once, then you achieve a certain filling. If you then try to improve on that filling, you will empty out atoms which are already in there, because all of this dynamics is purely unitary. So you can't repeat it to improve the filling. And so what we were wondering about is, can we use some irreversible process to improve on that filling? So basically, to do something which is quite frequently done in quantum optics, and it's called optical pumping there, where you just turn on a laser and leave it running until you get the desired fidelity. And so the question is, can we combine some irreversible processes, something that can be repeated over and over again, with some blocking mechanisms so that we can avoid doubly and higher occupied sites? And can we use them, such a scheme, to load an optical lattice with almost fidelity 1?
Can I ask my question?
Yes.
From an experimental point of view, is it straightforward to have to build a system so that the number of atoms and the number of lattice sites is the same?
Yes, because what they do is not trying to achieve exactly what you say, but they put a very shallow trapping potential in addition onto the system, so that there are several excess lattice sites, but they would be offset in energy a bit, and so the atoms gather in the center of the system. So you don't need to balance this one-on-one, but you just offset the other lattice sites a bit, and then it works.
Yes.
That's what is done in practice. And so the first thing, of course, that we thought about was using photons for that. And photons are the thing which most often is used in the irreversible process together with atoms. But if one looks at that, one sees that large momentum kicks and large energies prohibit you from doing anything in optical lattices. And in optical lattices, temperatures and the energies associated with these atoms are very, very small. They're always on the order of a few kilohertz. And so there is hardly any chance that with some photons which have much higher energies, we can do cooling in that low temperature regime. And so we looked at another possibility, and this is the spontaneous emission of fermions. So if we take an optical lattice, like I've drawn here, and put the optical lattice into some other degenerate gas, then an atom inside this optical lattice, when vibrating inside this lattice, can create fermions and can spontaneously emit fermions into this degenerate gas, just like an excited atom in an electronically excited state emits spontaneously a photon. And if one now looks at this process, then this is much more promising, because the energy ratios fit much better. It can be used in a much more, it matches the properties of atoms in an optical lattice much better. And so what we found is that, yes, this can be used for loading atoms into a lattice, and that's what I will discuss now, how that is done. In the meantime, we have also looked at different stuff, and this would be to cool atoms within the lowest Bloch band, so to get rid of any excess temperature that might still be there. Destroy spatial correlations between the atoms, so these fermion emissions would destroy any kind of spatial correlations between atoms sitting in different lattice sites. And what we are currently also doing is looking at how these fermions can mediate interactions between atoms in different lattice sites, so that we get some interactions between distant atoms mediated via fermions, in contrast to electromagnetism, that these interactions would be mediated by photons. So what we do in optical lattices is we use irreversible processes with fermions instead of using photons, and hope to get the same kind of structure of the dynamics again. Now, the idea for loading atoms into an optical lattice can be written down in three steps. The first step is, we take a reservoir, so this would be a degenerate gas, usually a Fermi gas, and take our one atom and put it into the first excited motional state of this optical lattice. This can be done by a laser transition. Then this atom inside this first excited state interacts with the reservoir, and this interaction with the reservoir causes a fermion to be emitted into the reservoir and acts like a spontaneous emission, bringing the atom from the first exciting state down into the lowest state. In the case of fermions, this can only happen if the lower side is empty. If a particle already sits in there, Fermi's block principle avoids any second atom in there, so this process cannot happen. And in the end, after we have particles down there in the lowest band, we just evaporate those particles which are still in the upper band. Now this scheme has the advantage of being repeatable. If I fail to produce a particle in each lapiside in the first run, I just repeat it and do the same thing again and again. There will hardly be any chance of the phonon to be around to excite atoms back up from the lowest state up into the first excited state. So this irreversibility introduced in the second step here allows one to repeat this scheme, just like in optical pumping. Now, in order to analyze this, one needs to just write down the different Hamiltonians. So we have a free Fermi gas here, this acts as the reservoir. We have the optical lattice. For simplicity, we neglect any type of interaction, so this interaction and any type of hopping. So this is just the excited state inside a trap, inside one of the lattice sites. And then the Raman Hamiltonian interacting or changing the internal state of the atoms. Now, the simplest thing one could imagine is to just turn on this laser very quickly and try to move atoms into the lattice. That doesn't really work, because it would mean that atoms can't move during this process. So if they don't move and I have a very high density of atoms, I could probably fill the lattice with enough atoms, but then I could just turn on the lattice and need any kind of this process. So in that case of large omega, the system is very easy to understand and easy to deal with, but we don't get the desired effects. So what we have to look at is the limit where this omega, so the transition rate of atoms from the reservoir into the optical lattice, is quite slow, so that the atoms are allowed to move in between. So an atom can now move inside its degenerate Fermi gas and be excited into the optical lattice where the free space is available still. And after doing this, we then have, let's say, an atom in this excited state up here, and this atom will then interact with the remaining particles in the degenerate gas by an interaction Hamiltonian of that type, where we have some coefficients here. And this is not drawn to scale. This interaction will cause one atom in the degenerate gas to be excited, and the atom inside the lattice to fall down into the lower band. Since the energies involved in here are usually bigger than these Fermi energies, this means that this atom that was in the degenerate gas originally is excited and leaves the trap, so it will leave the system, much like a spontaneously emitted photon leaves the system and hits the wall somewhere. So this emission of this atom is a spontaneous process. There is no chance of this atom to reappear and to take this atom back up again here, so reabsorption is negation. And so what we've now investigated, and I'm not going to go through that, through the calculations in very much detail, is how a laser pulse, which is scanned over this reservoir, can be used to drive the atoms into the first excited state and then let them fall down. The process in principle looks like this. The laser takes the atoms into this first excited band, then they drop down, emitting spontaneously some phonons in here. And afterwards, the laser is kept turned on in a region where there are no atoms anymore, so that remaining atoms in the upper lattice band can be removed. And now one looks at how well this works, it's amazingly good. So here is the filling per lattice site in the lower band as a function of time, and here the filling in the upper band. Now we leave that on for some time and get a filling here, where this is a logarithmic scale, that is on the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, after a reasonable time, which for experimental parameters translates into a few milliseconds. So after a few milliseconds time, we have reached an error for having a particle in one of these lattice sites of 10 to the minus 4 or less. And at the same time, the atoms in the upper band can be taken out of this upper band with almost perfect fidelity as well. So instead of having now a 10% error, which was achieved in experiments already, we would now have an error of 10 to the minus 5 or even less. So we get a quite drastic improvement, and in particular, the preparation of such a quantum memory would be good enough to start thinking about doing error correction. And I want to stress again the difference and the novelty of this approach is that you can just repeat it. So if it doesn't work very well, do it again, and you get more particles in there. The likelihood of atoms to be taken out again is almost zero. Okay, then now we have such a system. We have a quantum memory which has atoms in the places where we want them to be. And we now ask the question, how can we create an entangled state with them? And again, I want to do this in a very simple and in a doable way. And assume now to have such a chain of atoms, one atom in each lattice site, two internal states. And we now crank up the lattice potential quite a lot so that the atoms cannot hop on top of each other anymore. So the evolution that will now happen can be worked out from the original Bose-Hamiltonian that I had before, and turns out to be of that form here. So this Hamiltonian here describes the evolution of these particles with two internal states in the limit of having large interactions. The sigmas that I have here are Pauli operators where spin up and spin down corresponds to the two internal states which form the qubit. And there is now some hopping with sigma x and sigma y terms, and this corresponds to an interaction between these qubits and something like an effective magnetic field. And these parameters B and J here are determined by the optical lattice parameters, so they can be tuned. Now, this Hamiltonian, which describes the system, has been studied a lot, and it has been, for instance, used to transfer atoms or to transfer qubits from one end to the other. But it can also be used to create entangled states in a quite simple way. And the thing to note here is that this Hamiltonian, by doing a Jordan-Winger transformation, can be turned into a Hamiltonian of free fermions. So we get some non-interacting free fermions if we do a Jordan-Winger transformation. And then the ground state would correspond to a fermion in each of the lattice sites where the qubit is down, and no fermion in each of the lattice sites where the qubit is up. So qubit 0 and 1 correspond to fermion present and fermion not present. So what we have now is we have a system of effective fermions which obey Fermi statistics, but they don't obey the super selection rules. So we can create and destroy them because they actually correspond to bosonic atoms. And if one now looks at the dynamics of this Hamiltonian that I just had, then one sees that for a certain time that this Hamiltonian will mirror invert the position of the fermions. So if I run this Hamiltonian for a certain time, an atom or a fermion in position k will go to the position k bar, where k bar is the mirror inverted position on the chain. So turning on this Hamiltonian for some time will thus invert all these creation operators here and therefore create a phase. And this phase can be used to entangle the qubits. And so if one looks now at the evolution of this system, and I have here all spins up, then the time evolution does nothing. So we get no change at all. If we flip one of these atoms in there, so if we create one fermion in there, then what we'll get is just a flipped position fermion at the end with no phases, with no change in there. If we flip another atom in there, then the change of position between those two will cause a phase minus one in there. And if one continues this with larger numbers of qubits and larger numbers of fermions in there, one finds that this corresponds to a quantum network which just produces a controlled set gate between each pair of these atoms. And therefore, sending in just a state plus into this network results in a fully connected graph state, a graph state plus some reflection across the center of this system. And so what we have is, now without doing any gates, without just turning this Hamiltonian on for a certain time, we can create a fully connected graph state. And we have also looked into extensions of this system where in n steps, any arbitrary graph state can be generated without doing any additional two-qubit operations. So all we need is single qubit operations, operations on one qubit, and this Hamiltonian that I've presented that creates this fully connected graph state to connect any graph state we like. And therefore, the amount of experimental input or experimental control required for creating these states is quite reduced in comparison to having a network which tries to achieve that. And so in the final part of my talk, and I want to discuss how in an experiment we could now detect these entangled states. So we have them, we've tried to create them, we believe that we have got such states, but up to now no experiment was really able, in atoms at least, to verify that the states they get are indeed entangled. And there are, of course, many different possibilities for doing this, and a lot of tests have been developed. And we've been using one of these tests, which is not, I think, very popular. So what I want to talk about now is to how to use entropic inequalities to test for the entanglement of these states. So if we have a separable state, then this separable state fulfills these inequalities, so tracing out one particle after the other always increases the trace of the corresponding density operator squared, until finally tracing out all particles, we just get something that is one in this case. Now, any state that violates these, one of these inequalities is definitely an entangled state. So if one can measure these traces of rho squared and compare them, then one can find out whether a state is entangled or not. And what I will try to do now is to show that this is indeed possible in optical lattices, so that we can measure these traces of rho squared, measure them as we trace out more and more particles. And the way that this will be done was for two photons, or for two qubits, just first discussed in this paper by Arthur Eckert in 2002, where essentially what they say is that you need two copies of this state rho that you want to look at. So if there are two copies corresponding to two rows in our optical lattice, and then are able to swap, to create the swap operator which swaps these two qubits, then the trace of rho squared will determine the projection on the symmetric and antisymmetric subspaces. And now what we are going to do is just to extend this scheme and take now two rows in the optical lattice prepared in exactly the same way, and we run some beam splitters between each pair of atoms in there. The beam splitter between two atoms is very straightforward to implement. All you need to do is to lower the barrier in between these two atoms a little bit, and what will happen is that these two atoms undergo a beam splitter according to this hopping Hamiltonian here, which just causes the atoms to hop between the two lattice sides. So turning on this Hamiltonian for a certain time, allowing the atoms to hop from one row to the other, will implement beam splitters, and therefore what we will get is a scenario where the symmetric parts of rho j, where rho j is the density operator of an atom in one lattice side, is going onto a doubly occupied side here. So whenever this state is symmetric, after the beam splitter you get doubly occupied sides. And whenever this rho j is antisymmetric, we will get singly occupied sides. So such a beam splitter therefore transforms symmetric and antisymmetric parts of the density operator into doubly and singly occupied lattice sides. And doubly and singly occupied lattice sides are quite easy to distinguish in the experiment, because doubly occupied lattice sides have a quite large interaction energy, so their dynamics is completely different from singly occupied lattice sides. And also doubly occupied lattice sides undergo some inelastic collisions, so they're emptied out after some time. So once this beam splitter is run, therefore, in principle, one just has to wait for a certain time, and all these doubly occupied lattice sides will be gone, and all atoms which are still in the optical lattice will be atoms that originally were in singly occupied lattice sites. This experiment has been done already, so it was shown that that way one can indeed distinguish doubly and singly occupied lattice sites from one another, and we will now use this to work out but that the state, the original state rule, is entangled or not. Now, when one tries to do this with the help of these entropic inequalities, we find that these probabilities of having symmetric and anti-symmetric states are directly related to all these traces of the reduced density operators. And they are related in a linear way. So in principle, this set of equations can be inverted. Now, the problem with that is, of course, that the number of coefficients and the number of terms in there goes up exponentially with the size of the system. And also, measuring these probabilities here would require you to do a measurement which is spatially resolving. Now, that's very difficult to achieve, so we can't expect at the moment, at least experimentalists, to distinguish two atoms which are separated by only a few hundred nanometers. So what we were asking now is, well, first of all, what happens if we have no spatial resolution? Can we still say something about the system? And it turns out that yes, we can still say that the state is entangled. What happens if there are errors in the atom detection? And what happens if there are errors in the beam splitters? Now, before I go to this kind of more realistic scenario, not trying to directly invert this equation and find out what happens, I want to just make a remark. I have not yet found much about the strength of these entropic inequalities in comparison to entanglement weaknesses and in comparison to CHSH inequalities. So the only thing that I know about the power is that for the two-qubit state, which can always be written like that, and all the entanglement is described by this matrix Tij that can be diagonal, that in that case, any type of CHSH inequality would only detect states which are outside this red sphere here, whereas the entropic inequalities, and that means that we only have one experimental setup instead of many to determine the CHSH inequalities, would be able to determine all or to figure out all states. Is the other way around? No, sorry, that's the other way around. So CHSH inequalities only detect states outside this grid here, these black lines, whereas the entropic inequalities detect all states which are outside that sphere. So at least for two qubits, therefore, the entropic inequalities are stricter best than any CHSH inequality could be. I don't know about extensions to higher dimensional systems. So really, what is the power in terms of in comparison to entanglement weaknesses there? However, what we can do now is we can ask the question, what happens if we don't have any spatial resolution? So we assume that the experimentalists cannot resolve which of the optical lattice sites were singly or doubly occupied, but can just determine how many of the sites were singly occupied by effectively just counting the number of atoms they have left in the optical lattice after a certain time, and that's certainly something that they can do. And so what we do in order to find out about this is we calculate average traces over these reduced density operators, and but now instead of saying what is the, instead of working out traces with certain particles traced out, we ask what is the trace of rho squared with a certain given number of particles and average over all the different particles that can be traced out. Again, these traces fulfill the same type of inequalities where the trace of these rho squared has to go up as we trace out more and more particles. And again, we can write down a linear equation that relates the measured probabilities with these traces. And now, of course, we have only n different probabilities here, just corresponding to the number of particles, so a much smaller number. This is measurable. And you have only n such traces of rho squared. Now, that can be measured. And so it's worthwhile to invert this linear set of equations and to see what type of probabilities and traces we get for different states. Now, I've shown here a few. These are the probabilities that one would measure of finding a certain number of particles still left in the optical lattice with a total number of 10 lattice sites. And they, I mean, we can't say really much from them. But if we now invert the previous set of linear equations and work out what happens in these traces, then we see that for a total mixed state, for instance, this state will always obey, of course, all these inequalities, so nothing happens here, whereas the GFZ state, the cluster state, and the cluster state with some noise, they all violate these inequalities in a way that can be detected. So in really, in a way that, that's not just marginal, but quite drastic. So if we look at the GFZ state here, we get a high peak for finding 10 particles in the end, for this trace of row 10. And these cluster states, and even cluster states with some noise, start to violate these inequalities for each number of particles larger than half the number of particles in there. So therefore, these measurements would allow to detect GFZ state, cluster states, and we have tried a few others, and they always violated these inequalities in the way that is detected.
Is there some kind of interpretation of why it has that shape?
Of why?
Why it goes down and then goes up again?
Yes, there is an interpretation of that. And if if I was to plot here the trace of row 0, which is 1, then this would always be symmetric for any pure state. So we have just looked at pure states here and here. So this one is symmetric, this one is symmetric. And here with some phase noise in there, the symmetry is gone. So one can basically test whether a state is pure or not by looking at the symmetry of this. But other than that, we haven't found really a good reason for these shapes.
Isn't that the nature of the joint? You read it for right to left with single measurements breaking the entanglement with the cluster states after you do half the number of measurements of the number of particles, you get to a maximum mixed state, and then from 1 to 5, it looks like a maximum mixed state.
But that's not true. There's local correlations already in the cluster state. Of course, this doesn't look exactly like a
cluster state.
But most of the correlations, I think, in the cluster state are kind of local ones.
Yes.
If you have, I guess it depends on the degree of diversity. So this is the cluster state for the complete drought?
No, this is the cluster state that just
for a lattice.
A lattice.
Okay.
In 1D.
So then kind of most of the entanglement I would expect to be kind of on the degree graph, which is 5 qubits.
Yes.
So degree plus 1.
Then. Yeah, we have worked it out in a bit more detail in the paper, but I have no pictures of that. There's nothing really to.
But isn't G saying that when you go from 10 to 9, you basically.
Yeah.
Broken all the entanglement, so after that it's not behaving like a maximum. Why isn't the GHC from 1 to 9 behaving like a maximum in this state?
So this B is the GHC. If I go down here, then.
This isn't the maximum.
No, it's not the maximum.
You try to scale up all of the.
No.
Classically correlated, half all ups, all downs.
It doesn't look like a classically correlated state.
This is a classically correlated state here, which is the old constant, so that's why I didn't draw it.
Oh.
So that is just boring.
But after doing one measurement on the GHC state, doing more measurements doesn't change.
That's what this said. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've tested that for a number of different states, and I've just shown, I think, a few nice ones here. Okay, so much for entanglement detection. So in principle, what we can do now is we can detect whether a state is entangled or not by just testing whether these inequalities are violated or not. Now, if one assumes a little bit more about that state, and in particular assumes some kind of form that state has, then one can say even a bit more. So for instance, what we've looked at is a macroscopic superposition state of this form, where the catness, how these authors called it, would be given by this parameter gamma here. And the question now is, can we determine this parameter gamma, assuming that the state, the internal state that we have, looks like this? And indeed, that can be done. So we can take this state here and work out what its reduced traces are and find a direct relation with gamma and the converse conjugate of gamma. So by measuring these traces, one would be able to work out what this gamma is and give the degree of catness of such a state, assuming that it has that form, in an analytical way. For other states, I mean, these one D cluster states that were created in the experiment, one can do a similar thing, so one can work it out. The analytical equations look quite horrible, so I didn't put them down. But what one finds again is that these traces of rho squared are directly related with the phase phi that one puts into this cluster state. And so by measuring all these different traces, one can work out what the actual phi was. So again, by assuming a certain form of this state, assuming it is a cluster state with some entanglement phase phi in there, one can detect what the value of this phi is. So up to now, all that I've done assumes that everything, all the measurements and everything works perfectly. So now the question is, what happens if some of this, these measurements are done in an imperfect way? So in particular, what we investigated was what happens in the beam splitter error. So if the beam splitter doesn't work perfectly, but just keeps a bit of the wave function in the wrong place. And what happens if there are detection errors? So if an atom is lost by accident or something else goes wrong in the atom detection. And what we find is that the variances of the probabilities that are to be measured scale quite badly with these errors. So we get an exponential scaling of k times q and of n times p of the variances of the corresponding trace of rho squared. Now this means that the errors cannot be too large. So in particular, if I want to measure a certain number of k or n, then these errors have to be on the order of 1 over k. And this is an analytic bound that we found here. By numerical calculations, we found that in most cases, it seems that this n here can be replaced by a k. So we assume that really what we have is that p and q need to be on the order of 1 over k in order to get sufficiently small variances for in these measurements. So if you want to do such an experiment with a limited number of runs, then these beam splitter and detection errors should be on the order of 1 over the number of particles in the system. Now that's not too unreasonable. I mean, if one does look at such optical lattice systems in one dimension, they may have about 100 to 1,000 particles. So this means that if one can create beam splitters with an error of 1 per mil or a detection that only fails once out of 1,000 times, then these variances are still reasonably small, and one can get these probabilities in a reasonable number of measurement runs here. And the last question that I want to ask is, what happens if you now have limited spatial resolution? So up to now, I was assuming that the spatial resolution is not there at all. Now we can assume that the experimentalists have some spatial resolution and they can tell the box maybe where an atom came from. Is this good enough to say anything more than what I've just been talking about right now? And it turns out that one can again write down an equation relating the experimentally found distributions of particles to the actual distribution of particles. And this is again a linear set of equations which can be solved. So if we do that, we, however, find that you really don't gain much by having limited spatial resolution. So here is the variance of the measured values as a function of the resolution over the wavelength. So that's the original separation between the atoms. And one can see that for any resolution which is worse than one wavelength, one optical wavelength, the variance grows quite quickly. It grows again exponentially. And so if the resolution is not as good as the original separation of the atoms, you can't really gain much by doing more experiments. So these variances here scale very badly. So in effect, what I think this means is that without any spatial resolution, these measurements give quite a powerful tool to detect and maybe even to characterize such entangled states. Limited spatial resolution doesn't help a lot. So if such an experiment would try to go further and really try to work out what the individual particles' properties are, then better have a resolution that is as good as the optical lattice. So with this, I want to summarize. What I've tried to show is that there are ideas for, first of all, realizing a quantum memory in an optical lattice. So for realizing quantum memory that we have exactly one atom in each lattice site, so that we can really speak about the quantum memory with a reasonable number of atoms. So even bigger than what is done today. This can be done with a very high fidelity. We can then take these atoms and create entangled states, create multi-part entangled states which are useful for quantum computing without too much of an experimental hassle. So what I showed was not particularly difficult to do. I mean, there was no need for creating some kind of two qubit gates of all various forms, but essentially just to turn on and off the certain Hamiltonian, which is there for free, basically. And that this allows very easily to create graph states. And finally, I've shown that even without spatial resolution, it is possible to also detect these entangled states. So one cannot just create them, but one has the possibility to measure whether they were actually there or not. And this I want to end by listing the people who were involved in that. So the work was done by Rebecca Palmer and Stephen Clark, and then also by Carolina Moralves, who has in the meantime undergone some spontaneous admission into London Finance. Now is working there. And the first part of this work was done together with Andreas Wiesner and Andrew Daly, who work in the group of Peter Zoller in Innsbruck. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.
This metaphysics you used to test for entanglement, you said something was stronger than Bell's inequalities.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of necessary theoretical assumptions that go into interpreting those? I mean, for example, do you need to interpret that the correct beam splitter algae is applied?
Yes.
I mean, it could be that's what that's going on. You can simulate the same results.
I mean, what we assumed here was that these beam splitters were done perfectly. Yes, so that you really know the asymmetric and symmetric parts of your density operator.
So in a sense, it's different because with Bell's inequalities, they provide a test for sort of entangled and non-locality, which goes beyond the quantum theoretic framework, in general, any kind of theoretic framework. But it looks like this test is within the quantum theoretic framework.
Yes. No, it's not. I mean, not as far as I know, it's inside. So this would really, I mean.
So in that sense, it's weaker than building quality.
Where you can use it for testing entanglement. Can you talk about entanglement without quantum mechanics? So that's the odds of
life. Yeah.
We can test entanglement without using any quantum mechanics.
What is an entanglement?
Well, the point is that you don't believe quantum mechanics, but you're testing it to see whether people who do believe it are right. Yes. That's what that when people do Bell inequalities tests, that's kind of what they're talking about, right? I mean, except if they actually do the test.
Yes, okay. So in that sense, what I was assuming is that quantum mechanics is valid, and then you want to see whether you have any kind of state or not.
Okay.
But, yeah, I should be careful.
Maybe you're just less paranoid than I am.
So, thank you.